Boker Tov, everybody. Good morning. It's good to see you all. Had a break last week, so it's nice to see everybody back. I see some new faces. Remind me one more time your name. Ellen, and you also look new. What's your name? Leah. Welcome. And so you told me you're from Kew Garden Hills. And where are you from originally? New Jersey. Where in New Jersey? Teaneck, okay. I also from Teaneck. Okay, it's good to yeah, you should be proud of Teaneck. You should be proud of Teaneck. It's a good place. So, in our study here of Judaism and the isms, Judaism's encounter with other religions, we are now encountering Judaism and Hinduism. Now, let me say at the outset, I am no scholar of Hinduism. Never been to India. I can't say I've ever sat with a Hindu priest to discuss their theology or philosophy. So I'm really coming in here with very, very little background knowledge about Hinduism. I know a little bit about movies from Bollywood, but that, of course, these are stereotypes and generalizations, and it's not Hollywood, it's Bollywood. But you understand the point. I did take an Eastern Great Works of the East. And I took a course on, which some of the texts we studied were Hindu texts. So I have some books on my shelf, which I had to read. One of them here, the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Rig Veda. I mean, this is a long time ago that I read this stuff. So I can't say that I'm coming in with very little knowledge, and I want to be say that at the outset. There's a line by the Meiri that I heard the other day, Yadati sheyadati kshiyadati shelo yadati. Okay, so that's number one. And we're talking here about Judaism's encounter with the third or fourth biggest religion in the world. It numbers 1.2 billion members, 1.1 billion members. So it's important to understand, as we're going to see, that Hinduism is a very, very complex phenomenon. It's hard to call it even one religion. It's different groups and different sects that sort of get grouped together, but they don't necessarily see themselves all together, and there are different viewpoints and philosophies and ideas, and this is part of the challenge of addressing this encounter. But I want to start from the following controversy, which some of you may remember from 2004. And we're going to listen to a recording of a professor, a modern Orthodox Jew who spent the whole year teaching in a religious school in India. So we're gonna hear from him in just a little bit. The controversy is known as the Sheitel controversy, because in 2004, one of the Gedolei Hador, Rav Shalom Eliashiv, came out with a psak that any women who have wigs that are of Indian origin need to be burnt. Okay? Now, you say, "Oh, it's a big deal. It's a wig." You go to the shop and you get a wig. Someone estimated that the value of this could have been $1 billion worth of wigs being burnt. It's a lot of money. Okay? It's a lot of money. And yeah.
The last thing, like Eliashiv, was this Rabbi Edel Mizrach?
No, 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 no. Rabbi Yashiv was the Haredi Gadol of. He happened to have. Been connected to Rav Kook at one point and was a dayan for within the chief rabbinate, but he or the within the rabbinic council, but he was most certainly not Mizrahi, even though Mizrahi, right, east.
I mean,
but
in
no,
general,
he,
they
yeah.
Don't
But now, what was the problem here? Okay, and now he didn't actually pen this letter himself. It was a psak which was penned by his secretary of Yosef Efrati, saying that these wigs that come from a place called Tirupati, I'm going to tell you what that is in just a second, are considered tikrovet lavodazara. I'm going to explain all the terms. What is Tirupati? What is tikrovet lavodazara? Tirupati is a Hindu temple visited between every day by about 40,000 to 60,000 Hindus on a daily basis. Okay, it's a pretty big place. And in this complex, they have 600 barbers who are there to shave people who wanted to sort of donate their hair. Okay, and about 15,000 to 20,000 people get their hair cut on a daily basis. The hair never enters the temple, but it's in a complex right nearby. This hair is then placed in a vessel called a hundi, and then all the hair is sold to wig makers throughout the world, and that's how you get a sheitel. Okay, so this is the, you know, so now there are all these questions that were then raised. Is you know, and now we have to talk about what tikrovet l'avodah zarah is. Tikrovet l'avodah zarah is something that's karev, that's something that's used as a means towards sacrifice or worship in an idolatrous setting. Okay, but there are huge questions here. Okay, huge questions. How do you know that a wig actually came from this place in Tirupati, India? How do you know, is this a form of idolatry? I mean, is this a form of idol worship to cut one's hair? Why are they cutting their hair? Are they doing this because they want to appear, just sort of diminish themselves and remove their ego before they go and pray to whoever it is that they're praying to? Or is this an actual, like, sacrifice? And if it's a sacrifice, then maybe it is idolatrous. Okay, so, and there's a real problem by tikrovet l'avodah zarah, a certain stringency that exists by tikrovet l'avodah zarah, and that is that it can never lose its status. Other forms of idolatry, a non-Jew can mivatel, can nullify the status. By tikrovet l'avodah zarah, one cannot do this. It's mentioned explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeh Siman Kuf Lamed Tet. So there's no way of undoing the status once the status comes into existence. Okay? Now, we're going to look into the sugya a little bit. I don't want to go too deep. Just a little bit so you get a sense of what's at stake here and how you define tikrovet. Okay, so if you look on the third source here, Talmud Bavli Avodah Zarah Nun Aleph. Okay? Talking about different objects used for idolatry. If one found money, did you not get a source? Let me give it. If one found money, a garment or vessels at the head of Mercury. Mercury was some idol. These are permitted. If one found vine branches laden with clusters of grapes, or wreaths made of stalks, or containers of wine, oil, or flour, any other items of the likes of which is sacrificed on the altar there, it is prohibited. Okay, we're getting a sense of what would be considered tikrovet, what wouldn't be. And there's a huge machloket in the Rishonim, which we'll get to in just a second. Rav Nachman says that Rabbi Baravua said, the Rav says, in the case of an object of idol worship that is worshipped by means of a stick. So let's say you have an idol that you break a stick over it. So if one broke a stick before it, he is liable, and the stick is rendered prohibited. If he threw a stick before it, he is liable, as its typical manner of worship involves a stick, but the stick is not rendered prohibited. There's all these debates about this. What is considered tikrovet, what's not considered tikrovet, etc. The key point is that there are different opinions, and ultimately, the Shulchan Aruch rules, somewhat stringently, that anything that's been used in a form of worship that you have in the Beit HaMikdash, or anything that was used literally by non-Jews for idolatrous worship, would be considered tikrovet avodah zarah. Okay? And that's the conclusion he comes to. The Rambam goes even further, by the way. The Rambam says anything, and it's quoted by the Shachir in Siman Kuf Lamed Tet, anything that's even brought into their temple would be considered tikrovet avodah zarah, and we may not derive benefit from it. Okay, and wearing a shekel is one form of deriving benefit. Okay, so this was this. Now, what ultimately Rav Yashiv in 1989, this issue was brought to him, and he ruled leniently. Why? Because the information that he was told at the time was that this is not a form of worship. People are just doing this to, again, to lower their ego before they go into the temple to worship. And so he ruled leniently. Over time, by 2004, people came back and said, listen, this is you don't have the facts right. Okay, this is an integral part of Hindu worship. And so he sent a messenger of his, someone by the name of Rav Yosef Duner, if I'm not mistaken, Rav Aaron Duner, excuse me. He went to Tirupati for 48 hours to examine what was happening there, and he spoke to worshippers and to the priests and to the barbers to try to figure out what's happening there. And he came with a number of conclusions. First of all, people said they cut their hair because the idols liked it. Number two, some hair was being brought into the temple. Number three, when they were cutting their hair, they were naming the name of the idol. Number four, at the complex where they would cut their hair, there was an idol of sorts, you know, at the entrance to the building. So now, Rav Yashiv comes back and says, this is 2004, these shetels need to be burnt. Okay, and many poskim ruled along with him. Some ruled otherwise, some were more lenient. There was a whole debate, and you can imagine a lot of money was lost for those who did burn there. I'm not taking judgment upon, you know, who did and who didn't burn this. But this is the key point here, is that this is probably the most exposure that your typical Orthodox Jew has had to Hinduism, is whether they need to burn their sheitel or not, if these are people, if you're a person who has a sheitel. You know, and to some degree, it captures the, well, we're going to see a very severe critique of this whole halachic discourse in just a second. But to some degree, it speaks to the narrowness through which we might see Hinduism and the lack of exposure that we have to the religion. Now, interestingly, another group of people outside of, you know, us Orthodox Jews who like to follow halacha, is the fact that there are many, many Israelis who have traveled in the last years to Nepal and India and the, you know, Southeast Asia to, you know, to just hang around and to take a break from the army, but also in search of spirituality. Okay? And that's a whole other type of encounter. Anyone have, I don't know, have any cousins or children or friends who've, you know, who've done this? Yeah, we all know people who have done this. And so, so this is like another form of sort of encounter that we've had with Hinduism. It's not quite on the counter, a theological encounter per se, between rabbis and priests, or, you know, between philosophers of our two religions, but it's between regular Jews who are sort of looking for something and a certain experience that you could have in the Indian subcontinent. Okay, and I just want to share with you one you know, sort of eyewitness to this experience. Go to page three of the page four of the source sheet. Okay, this is a testimony of an Israeli writer. Okay, this comes from an article by Alon Goshen Gotzin. In a book, Jewish Theology in the World and World Religions, and this is an article called Encountering Judaism. So he says, I conclude this section by sharing the testimony of an Israeli writer speaking of the impressions of her first visit to India. Rivka Miriam is observant and active in Torah study in various literary and religious forums. Her knowledge of Torah allows her to relate to her experience in India in terms taken from classical Jewish texts. Her testimony confirms the suggestion I've just made, and points to what might be the source of India and Hinduism's appeal for Israelis and Jews. And now to divinity. Meeting its expression in India brought about a transformation in me. We Jews employ the common expression, there is no place that is devoid of him. Okay. Leit makom. I don't remember the exact phrase. There's no place where God's presence doesn't exist. In India, I discovered a world where it is indeed, where indeed so it is. I discovered the world in which there is no one who does not believe. I discovered a world where one sees divinity in every tree and in every stone, but also in every deed and in every matter. The entire world is full of his glory. Seeing divinity in India brought about a transformation in me. Indeed, there I saw a place full of faith. Another, different way to believe, a path that may have been uprooted from us when, as the Talmud tells, the evil inclination for idol worship was uprooted. And perhaps together with that uprooting, a part of faith as such was also uprooted. This is referencing a Gemara which recognizes that we don't have the same desire to worship idols today. But there's also a recognition that that sense of spirituality or godliness may have also vanished from the world along with that, you know, the desire for idolatry. Okay, these two things come hand in hand. They're different sides of the coin. So this is a, you know, just a really fascinating account, and there are probably many people who might attest to this. I have an old neighbor of mine who's now some big banker on Wall Street, you know, who told me that, and he's not a religious person, but he went to India for some friend's wedding, and he said he's never encountered such a spiritual place in his life. So this is something that clearly touches spiritual seekers and even capitalists on Wall Street, you know, who are not necessarily seeking out spirituality or religion. So really, really just, you know, fascinating. And this raises some questions for us. What is it about Hinduism that draws certain Jews there? Does it have certain things that Judaism doesn't have? How is it different? How is it similar? And how are we supposed to engage with it? Is this even permitted for people to go to India and spend some time in an ashram? Are they engaging in idolatry of avodah zarah? I mean, this is a serious question. The first encounter we spoke about was Judaism and paganism. Yeah. Well, is this just another iteration of that same debate? How do we look at Hinduism? What is Hinduism as a religion, as a culture? And so we're going to continue now with a podcast by a person by the name of Dr. Alan Brill. Does anybody know who Dr. Alan Brill is? He's a former professor at Yeshiva University. He now teaches at Seton Hall University. And he's going to tell you what he was doing in India. So let me just turn on the recorder. I'm gonna pause the recording, okay? So just remind me after we're done with Dr. Alan Brill to put on the recording again. Who's gonna remind me? Okay, good. Okay, I'm pausing for a second. So continuing where we left off, I'm just curious. What's your impression of this this recording, this conversation with Dr. Alan Brill? What do you think? What? It makes a lot of sense. Okay. Any new insights? What do you think? Would you say, yeah?
It reminds me of a story a friend of mine told me. He and his friends went to India together, mm-hmm. and they realized that they needed to get to the Professor.
Yeah.
And they needed some help getting there because it's quite a distance.
Yeah.
And when they explained to the local people that, well, there's a festival and we have to go worship our God, they were like, oh, great. And they were completely open-minded and everybody understood the importance of it. And they got a lot of help to get where they needed to get to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting.
The people there were like, oh, of course you have to go worship your God. Like, that makes total sense.
Okay, now what this conversation does is it complicates how we might have perceived Hinduism. And I want to share with you, sort of a response, sort of severe critique by Rav Daniel, Professor Daniel Sperber. He's a professor, I think, still at Bar Ilan University of Jewish Law and History. And if you look on page 2, he has an article here, How Not to Make Halachic Rulings. Okay? Now, the general thrust of this article is as follows. In a series of articles and publications, I discussed the question how halachic decisors poskim should act in our day and age, arguing that they should seek to bring people closer to a love of Judaism and halacha, to be inclusive rather than exclusive, and to practice what I called friendly decision-making, psika ididutit. Okay? And then he brings a few examples of this. One example that he brings is by the Sheitel controversy. We're not going to read the beginning part. You could read about it a little bit. Go to the bold-faced words, virtually. Okay? Virtually. Now, this is what he thinks is a problem, what was lacking from that conversation. Virtually none of those learned sages who wrote about this issue had any real knowledge of India, Indian religion or languages, and I suspect that the majority had never even been in India, and certainly not in Tirupati. It is true that a small mission was sent for a few days to examine the temple, but none of the members had the competence, the linguistic abilities, etc., as they themselves admitted, to make a real evaluation of the pilgrims' hair-shaving activities. More surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, none of the experts in the field of Indian studies were consulted. Neither, for example, Professor David Shulman of the Hebrew University, an internationally acclaimed Indologist, nor Rabbi Alan Unterman of Manchester University, who did his doctorate in India on Indian religion, nor Professor P.V. Wiswanath, a devout Jew of South Indian origin, now living in New Jersey, maybe even Teaneck, nor even the local Indian rabbis and authorities living in Mumbai and Delhi. One of the few rabbinic authorities to examine the issue systematically from all points of view was the renowned posuk of Menashe Klein, whose numerous volumes of our sponsor very rather acclaimed and largely accepted also by the Haredi communities. Incidentally, he surmises that around 1 million women wear such shaitels, whose cost is upward of $1,000 each, so the total destruction of the wigs may amount to as much as $1 billion. Hefseid Maruba, enormous monetary loss, an important consideration to be taken into account by a halachist. And even if his assessment has been seen as somewhat exaggerated, the halachic point he made is certainly pertinent. His conclusion was that the shaitels were not prohibited, but he counseled against wearing them for other reasons. Now, without even making an equivocal statement as to whether the Tirupati hair constitutes tikrovet avodazara or not, my point is that the halachic procedure whereby the rulings were concluded was highly flawed and therefore totally unsatisfactory. The decisor posik bears a great burden of responsibility before making a ruling that may incur the loss of thousands of dollars to thousands of individual women, perhaps cause them deep anguish in learning that they've been trespassing so serious a prohibition. Now, Alon Goshen takes this point even further, and what bothered him, I don't have the book here, was that no one ever addressed the fundamental question in their halachic responses, is Hinduism even Avodah Zarah? Is the religion Avodah Zarah or not? We assume it is, because of what we may know about it on a superficial level, but is it really Avodah Zarah? Again, I'm not taking sides here. I'm not at all a scholar on this, but I'm just sharing the different points of view that that came out. Now, he's a scholar, Alon Goshen. He's not a posek, but this is his view, you know, from a scholarly standpoint. Now, Sperber also points out here, he has a footnote in this article that he wrote, on the 5th and 6th of February this year, a few years ago, I participated in the first Hindu-Jewish leadership summit at Delhi, India. I think Rabbi Metzger, the chief rabbi, was part of this. This summit was attended, by a delegation of the chief rabbi of Israel and some prominent European rabbis and religious leaders of the Hindu Dharma. I was asked to participate because I served briefly as a rabbi in India many years ago and was therefore thought to have some understanding of Indian culture and religion. Many leading acharyas and swamis from all over India were present, and a very lively and probing dialogue took place. In our discussions, we asked them whether Hinduism is a polytheistic and idolatrous religion, and they all unanimously and most vigorously denied such an assertion, explaining the apparent outward manifestations of idolatry in a completely different fashion. At the end of the conference, a declaration of mutual understanding and cooperation was co-signed by all participants. Perhaps the most significant clause in the whole document in this context is the opening one. The participants affirm that their respective traditions teach faith in one supreme being who is the ultimate reality, who has created this world in his blessed divinity, who has communicated divine ways of action for humanity for different peoples in different times and places. I wonder whether the learned rabbis who prohibited the use of Tirupati based shetos would have ruled differently had they had this document before them. Perhaps not. Perhaps the way in which Indian religion's authorities understand their own religion is irrelevant to them. They know better, even if it causes a loss of millions of dollars and many heartbreaks. Okay, so this is Rabbi Sperber's view on the entire halachic discourse. But now we have to get to the fundamental question. And, and try to understand a little bit better, is Hinduism considered Avodah Zarah? You have a comment to make? Yeah.
Remember a few years ago, Benny Lavell told that someone in the Far East, and he saw this couple bringing mincha, some sort of
offering. Oh, I've heard this. Yeah, you go on, yeah.
He asked them, he said, that a child who was sick is better, and they wanted to bring, thank God. So he asked them, and does the God eat it? And they looked at him like, what are you, an idiot? It's symbolic. The whole thing is symbolic.
Interesting. So there's a lot to learn here. Now, one of the fundamental problems, there's a real challenge that we have is, who speaks for Hinduism? Who speaks for it? And how do you define it? Can you even define it? Is it defined by worshippers? Is it defined by the masses? Is it defined by their philosophers? By their priests? Who defines, is it people, thinkers today? Is it thinkers from the 11th century? So these are not easy questions. And if you look at the top of page 6 here, Alon Goshen here has in his article, he thinks the exclusive, underline words here, the exclusive appeal to worship while ignoring philosophical understandings of the religion is the root problem. It points to a weakness in the classical Jewish approach and reminds us of how difficult it is to achieve a balanced understanding of Hindu religious life. Even if we concede there is value in sending a rabbinic emissary, who should have spoken to? The priests who received gifts for the deity, the heads of the various spiritual schools and dynasties who honor the site and frequent it on regular pilgrimages. If the latter, the meaning of Hinduism might be found outside the temple among a narrow section of its users, etc., etc. Go to the next side here. Who holds the key to the proper interpretation of Hinduism, and whose voice should we take into account as we seek to understand Hinduism in relation to the Jewish concern with Avodah Zarah? And he goes through all the different possibilities. You know, it's sort of like someone says, hey, those Jews, they evade taxes. They don't pay their taxes. And you say, wait a second, don't judge Judaism by the Jews. Judge it by its doctrine, by its creed, by its great scholars, by Gedolim from generation to generation. Don't judge it by the Jew on the street who's, you know, some Jews, you know, not so... He's not impeccable in his behavior. He's corrupt, or you know, did something inappropriate. To some degree, we have some of the same questions. Although we would agree, who speaks for Judaism, we agree. We have Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars, poskim, leaders of the generation. There are different leaders. To that degree, it's decentralized. We used to have a Sanhedrin, which we don't have anymore today. But we do. We definitely have established religious leaders. Especially within the traditional and Orthodox Judaism. So this is challenge number one. Now, Now, I want to share with you different models of how to potentially reach some conclusions about this. So first of all, I want to share with you Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog writes in an essay, he wrote a responsa about what to do with the fact that Christians and Muslims live in the land of Israel. You have a Christian living in the land of Israel, and he's worshiping in his church. And now that we have Jewish sovereignty here, and he's writing this in late 1940s, 1948, 1949, what do we do? Are we allowed to permit Christian worship in churches in Medinat Israel? Is this permitted? You know, what's the problem? We have a responsibility to destroy Avodah Zarah. And maybe one should, maybe we have to prohibit this now that we are in power. This little pamphlet, I actually have a copy of it. It's, they put it out as Nochrim B'Medinat Yehudit. Okay, this is a little book that they put out based on his tshuva. Now, at the end of the book, at the end of the chapter, after going through what to do with Christianity and Islam, and he comes to the conclusion that, he has a number of conclusions, but one thing that he says is that, we are only able to have a state based on the affirmation or the agreement of the United Nations and countries of the world. And if we were to not treat other religions so nicely, we might lose that international recognition. Again, this is close after 1947, November 29th, where the UN did play a significant role in at least, voting positively. It's probably the last time they voted in our favor in the United Nations for the State of Israel. Actually, Rav Soloveitchik has a very interesting comment. He says it's possible the United Nations was created for that one vote, because thereafter they haven't lived up to their purpose. But, so he says we have to have take a sort of big picture. There are issues of Kiddush Hashem, issues of Eiva, not causing unnecessary hatred, of their Pikuach Nefesh, not causing danger, etc. But then at the end of the article, and you have this on your source sheet here, on page 3. Go to page 3 for a second. Okay, you see what Rav Herzog says. He sort of raises an interesting question. Second?
What about
missionaries? Okay, missionaries is obviously, more complicated. But if talking about now just a Christian worshiping on his own, not trying to missionize and proselytize. Eineni yodea, he says in the last paragraph here, Ima she'ela shel rishayon negoyim bilti notzrim uvilti muslimim. What about non-Christian, non-Islamic people? Lavo lihitashev baretz, can they come to the land and worship here? The thimidat chukei Ahigira bilvad, according to the laws of Higiraz of immigration, I guess. Ta'ale ala perek ba'atid akarov. This will obviously become a real question. Hagoyim hatarbutim she'afshar lachshov aleihem bekesher im zeh heim ahodim. The people that we're going to have to think about are the Hodim, the Hindus, Hasinim, okay, the Hayapanim. Uvenogea lehem adayin enenu barurli she'afilu elu Einam ovdim b'shituf. Ki lo lamadati dikaru yetatotem v'tarchei apuchan shelahem. He says, I don't know how to look at their status. I don't know how to define their status from a halachic standpoint. And he uses a term here. What term does he use? Shituf. What's shituf? We have a phrase in Hebrew, shituf pe'ula. What's shituf? Participation or association. Okay? And now, so this notion of shituf plays a critical role in halachic history. Okay? And let's understand what he's referring to here when he speaks about shituf. Now, let's go back to the Middle Ages for a second. And we actually discussed this earlier when we discussed Christianity. Jews are living in Christian lands. Are Christians considered idolaters? Yes or no? So the Rambam says absolutely yes. Okay? Muslims are not, the Christians are. Now the Balei Tosafot, who are Jews, lived in France and Germany, they come up with the following notion, that worshiping the Trinity and Christian, belief is not monotheism. It's not. It's sort of monotheism plus worshiping something else at the same time. So it's like, it's, you know, it's like, I get maybe a bishituf is in, including something else in your worship. You're worshiping God, but also Jesus, you know, whatever, right? Whatever that means for them, the Trinity, okay? So it's sort of God worship in a monotheistic sense, but it's plus something else. Now, how do we look at this plus something else? So Rabbeinu Tam comes up with the following conclusion. He says, listen, we Jews, we are commanded to worship pure monotheism. But non-Jews, we would like them to worship pure monotheism, but they, you know, they have the laws of seven laws of Noach, Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach. Included in the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach is actually a slightly lower standard for non-Jews. So they don't, you know, they're following the seven laws of Noach, even if they engage in shituf. Now, would this apply for a pagan who's worshiping all these different gods? No. But it applies to someone who has a notion of the one God plus something else. Okay, shituf. That's shituf. And this enabled Jews to engage in certain business activity and not be as wary of, you know, maybe engaging in business, especially around wine and other things, spent around Christian holidays, there are problems. You know, this avoids or it neutralizes some of these issues. Okay, this is not saying that Christianity is not some form of idolatry. It is sort of, it's quasi-ish, but non-Jews have a lower standard, and that's okay. For a Jew, Christianity would be Avodah Zarah. For a non-Jew, it's Shituf, and they could live in our, you know, in our presence and live in the land of Israel, and we could deal with it. Okay? Now, this is the notion of Shituf. Can one apply the notion of Shituf to Hinduism? Okay? Can you apply the notion of Shituf to Hinduism and say, hey, Hinduism also, they have this notion of one God. Look at the declaration they made with the chief rabbinate of Israel. Okay? Yes, they have all these other representations and symbols and associations, but these are just accessories in a sense. These are, it's God plus. Okay? It doesn't mean they don't believe in the one God. Yeah.
They have a lot of different gods, but none of them are actually on the level of the creator of the universe.
Okay, so this is part of the, this is exactly part of the question.
Yeah. Hmm? They don't see them that way.
Correct.
But
so,
when they
made
that
declaration, they say, "Say again, one day." Okay, again, I, you know, yeah, there's a lot to explore here, no doubt. Now, there is, as you can see from the Shetel controversy, sort of the overwhelming assumption or presumption was that Hinduism is Avodah Zarah. But there's one rabbi who's actually tackled this in a little bit more detail. A very serious rabbi. His name is Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz, who I'm sure everybody here has heard of. If you go to page 6, we can see he wrote an article, Peace Without Conciliation, The Irrelevance of Tolerance in Judaism. Okay? Doesn't sound like such a friendly article, or such an inclusive article. And yet we're going to see something striking here. Okay? Good. Let's read on the left side of page 6. What about Indic religions and various kinds of Buddhism? Again, I do not believe that a definitive solution is possible, but a partial solution may be considered. It is important to introduce a distinction between theology and religious practice. In the ancient religions grouped under the name of Hinduism, there are many gods and local shrines. But the theological principles that guide belief and provide a uniformity of moral standards assume that all the deities revered in India or elsewhere are forms of, expressions of, or names for one ultimate reality or God. Okay, so this is who speaks for Hinduism according to Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz? Is it the worshippers, the guy in the street who can't read, or is it the theologians? It's the theologians, who understand that the symbols are just that. They're symbols. They're not gods in and of themselves. Maybe the guy on the street doesn't understand this, but certainly the theologians do. Okay, let's go on. Saivitas proposes Siva as the best name among many names for this ultimacy. Vasnavatis, these are different groups within Hinduism, prefer Vishnu or Krishna. Atman in Upanishadic word for the same principle, and Brahman is perhaps the most common way among non-Muslim, non-Christian Indians of naming ultimacy. By the standards of Jewish laws applied to Jews, Hinduism and Buddhism do not count as monotheistic traditions. For Jews, they're not monotheistic. However, the essential point of the Noahide law is that the standards of Jewish law do not apply to non-Jews. Radically pure monotheism is expected by Judaism only from Jews. The Noahide laws do not preclude Gentile religions from developing softer, more complex, and compromised forms of monotheism. Under the Noahide laws, it is possible to assume that Hinduism and Buddhism are sufficiently monotheistic in principle for moral Hindus and Buddhists to enter the Gentiles' gate into heaven. Jewish law regards the compromises made or tolerated by the world's major religions as ways of rendering essentially monotheistic theologies easier in practice for large populations of adherents. The fierceness of Islamic opposition to compromises has no counterpart in Judaism. In Islam, it is seriously blasphemous for anyone of whatever faith to combine belief in the one God with popularities about other heavenly powers or with subtle theological doctrines such as the Trinity. Islam cannot tolerate such compromises because the truth that they violate is applicable universally and not simply to Muslims. The problem is that Islam is radically monotheistic like Judaism, yet is also, unlike Judaism, which is originally of one people, universalistic as well. He makes a very critical distinction here. In Islam, everybody needs to be monotheistic, and there are no distinctions. It has to be universally applied. In Judaism, we believe we're the chosen people. We have certain standards and expectations, but other religions, other people have different expectations. As long as they meet a certain standard of monotheism of some sort, then they can do whatever they go on to do. Whereas for Islam, if you don't believe in the one God, you are considered an infidel, and you might be killed. So this is really quite a radical position. Okay, he's the only Rav, only Posek, to sort of come to this conclusion. This is an article, though. It's not a tshuva. Okay, it's not necessary. Or is it a tshuva? Is this a responsa? You know, that's meant to be put on the, you know, in the shelf in the Beit Midrash, or does this go on the library shelf in some Hebrew University or Bar Ilan University library? Yeah, that's sort of one of the questions here that's being raised. But Alon Goshen points out that there's actually something quite radical about what Rav Adin Steindl is doing here, and for a number of reasons. Number one, he's taking this notion of shituf, which was applied locally in a very specific context to Christianity, and he generalizes it. He makes this a cornerstone of Jewish theology, that Judaism, by definition, believes that there are different sort of standards and expectations of different groups. And he goes on, he says even further, there are Kohanim. Kohanim have certain standards, okay, and this came up in the first Gemara and Masachet Brachot, for those who started Daf Yomi yesterday. You know, Kohanim nichmasim lachol b'trumatan, and then there's Yisrael, and there's the Levi'im as well, and then there are non-Jews, and you know, and there's like different standards, and so that's number one. But the other thing that's significant here is Rav Steinzelt even goes on to say, well, the Rambam, who felt that Christianity was avodah zarah, he sort of historicizes the Rambam. He says, the Rambam, he didn't really have exposure to Christianity. He was in Spain. He only encountered Muslims. There was the Berlin Wall, if you will, of sorts, between Muslims and Christians. They didn't interact all that much. The Rambam certainly didn't interact with Christians. So he historicizes even like, so the Rambam says, Christianity is over the Zara, you know. So again, it makes more room for interpretation and openness surrounding these issues. He also is basing Hinduism on a theological interpretation. One could look at it and say, hey, but look at the guy in the street. How are they worshiping? What are they doing? How are they behaving? And that might, you might come up with a very different perspective. But something else that he points out that's interesting about Steinzelt, anybody know what else Steinzelt does in his free time? Anybody know what else he's done in his career? I mean, he's an unbelievable, he's incredibly prolific. First of all, he wrote a commentary on the Gemara. He's the only individual, maybe since, I don't know, even Rashi didn't finish all of the Gemara. We don't have all of Rashi. He wrote a commentary on all of Shas, okay? Art Scroll was, you know, and commentary was put together by, I don't know, 50 different Torah scholars. This is one person doing it. That's number one. Number two, he's written extensively on a whole range of different issues. But he's also very interested in Kabbalah, in Chassidut. Okay, so he's more Kabbalistically minded rabbi. He started a school, which also, sort of based on some of these ideas. So Goshen points out on the bottom right on page 6, it is interesting that the Kabbalistic tradition that informs his theological thinking may be described in the same words. To the outsider, there appear to be structural similarity between Kabbalistic, Trinitarian, and Hindu understandings of God. On the outset, I'm not saying that's fundamentally true, but it is as no accident that Kabbalistically minded rabbi entertains notions of softer and more complex monotheism. Hinduism is compromised monotheism, and as such is valid. Okay, so interesting that it's not by chance that it's specifically Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz who comes to this conclusion. Now this is the model of Shituf. And there's one scholar, as you see, Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz, who thinks that Hinduism, we might be able to look at it in a positive, more positive sense, not as Avodah Zarah, based on this. There is one more model. Anybody know what the other model is in medieval times? That's the model of Rav Menachem HaMe'iri. Okay, we spoke about him as well. Me'iri was a scholar in Provence, in southern France, and he comes up with a different explanation for why he does not think Christianity is Avodah Zarah, and we're going to see how that applies here. Anyone know what the Me'iri says? We studied this inside a little bit. What does the Me'iri say? The Me'iri says, yeah?
Pagans back then were...
Exactly. It's distinguished between pagans, okay, heathens is probably the right term, and people who are part of civilized religion, organized religion, and that they have certain morals and norms and ethos, and they're civilized people. When we talk about pagans in the Torah, we're talking about the Vikings. We're talking about barbarians, Genghis Khan. We're talking about, things that people watch on a certain TV show, which they probably shouldn't be watching, which is a very popular series, okay, which I'm not going to name because it's going to go on Y Torah, but the Hamevin Yavin. But, you understand that's who we're talking about, barbarians, okay? We're not talking about people who are part of organized religion, which means that Muslims, Christians, by definition, are considered, they're not Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is something much more basic and archaic and barbaric. And one can make the case that this would apply to Hinduism as well. And Hinduism also, it's a religion that teaches about self-discipline, and there are certain values and ethics, and it's meant to raise a person up spiritually, has a notion of God and spirituality. So he thinks this, Goshen argues that it should be included as well. Now, there are some challenges, no doubt. Some of the challenges are certain practices in Hinduism, which one can make the case are very immoral. Again, I'm not a scholar on this, but there are certain prostitutes dancing in the temples and... women being, when their husbands died, they were burnt along with their husbands. I don't know if these things are still practiced today. I just want to make that clear. But, some ideas in their tradition. Yeah, okay. That is not, yeah, they do have... Yes, they're strict. They're vegetarian. I mean, one can make the case that there's a certain immorality in... caring more about the life of an animal than human beings, okay? And, again, these might be generalizations. What I just said may be a generalization. I had a math teacher in 10th grade who, someone would say, holy cow, she'd say, only in India. That was always her. That was her joke. But anyway, another challenge is that saints, that teachers... are worshipped, and not just learn from them, but they're sort of worshipped as godly, divine figures, okay? So this is another problem. I mean, even in Christianity, they only worship Jesus after he died, but not while he was alive. So, that's a challenge that, again, these are not easy issues and not easy to resolve, what one's psak should be about these things. Although I would just say, it should be understood, I want to make this very clear, the vast majority of poskim would say, you should not go into a Hindu temple and you shouldn't be going to an ashram. And and these different things. Specific cases might vary, but generally. But again, there is flexibility here, and there is a variety of opinions on these issues. So the Meiri's model, you know, might serve as an interesting model also to be more inclusive of Hinduism within a non-idolatrous category. Okay, but I want to conclude with one final point. Let's go to, and obviously there's a lot more to discuss here. Let's go to page 4 and 5. Okay. No, the recording's still on. No, we're not going back to the Alan Burr recording. But, okay. Now, in this page here, we have a really interesting insight by Alan Goshen, about why it is that so many Jews seek out Hinduism, Buddhism, Eastern religions. He said, in some sense, such a model in turn to Indian spirituality generally may be taken as a sign of crisis. Of course, crisis contains opportunity and holds within it the promise of growth. While this type of spiritual encounter may be driven by the desire for growth, this desire is nevertheless fed by crisis in Jewish spiritual reality. Talk of, quote, spirituality veils what can be considered the greatest aspect of Jewish spiritual crisis, that most of Judaism is unable to talk of God or to provide a conscious relationship with Him. Different people would see Judaism's present crisis differently. While some see it in terms of identity and others in terms of continuity, still others conceive of it in terms of either learning or practice. In the present context, I would like to argue that Judaism's deepest crisis concerns God. Judaism is a religion that centers around God, but that to a large extent has lost touch with the living God. God has not lost touch with Judaism, nor have the people of Israel lost their faith in God. But Judaism has lost to a significant extent the awareness of God at its center, and the ability to structure the entire life of the religious community, let alone the people of Israel, around access to divine presence and its grounding in the community's life. Saying we don't have enough spirituality in Judaism. Look how people flocked to Rav Shlomo Karlbach. Look at the draw to Hasidut today. Okay? And, you know, you see why. I mean, again, I am not critiquing this at all. I'm in the cycle myself. Look at Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi is the most unbelievable thing, but it's very intellectual. It's very cerebral. It's very textually great. It's all text. It's all text. Okay? Would you say there's spirituality in studying Daf Yomi? So that depends how you define spirituality. I remember an article called Religion and Law by Rabbi Dr. Yitzchak Isidor Tversky, who's a professor at Harvard. He says spirituality in Judaism is a lot more intellectual than it is in other religions. There's certainly truth to that. But we could all agree that, you know, that going through the Shakla Vitaria of a Gemara is not a spirit. It wouldn't be, the first word you would come to, you know, would come to your mind would not be, wow, this is so spiritual. Right, it's just not how might you. In contrast to, if you go to a kululam at the women's daf yomi siyum, people come. Wow, what an experience to sing all together and to experience something together. Okay, so you know, again, the primary experiences in Judaism tend to be a lot more intellectual and sometimes less spiritual. Okay, in the sense that people use it in the outside world. This loss has deep historical roots and may itself be an expression of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the loss of prophecy, and a long history of exile. This loss is, to my mind, included in what Kabbalists speak of when they refer to the exile of the Shekhinah. So Kabbalah, by the way, this is also, Kabbalah might address some of these problems. Okay, maybe we need more Kabbalah in our lives. Jews are both a faithful people and a people of faith, but their religious life is presently constructed so that other religions' values occupy places of primary importance, often eclipsing God's centrality within the religious system. Okay, skip to the next page. Go to page 5. The exile of God is hiding the difficulty in finding or accessing Him, however we conceptualize it, seems to me to be the heart of the Jewish spiritual crisis. And it is only when we're able to confront the fact that we are in this crisis that we may consider what the turn to Indian spirituality seeks to heal. It is not only that Jews find a spirituality in India that addresses a deep hunger in their souls. Rather, India makes available a directness of approach to God that is often lacking in Judaism. This direct approach to God may be the hallmark of Indian spiritual life, and why it is so attractive to Jews. Why, when Jews conceive of the goals of the religious life, few of us think of communion or relationship with God, let alone consider the only thing worth desiring. We seek happiness, family life, the well-being of our group, a life of values, learning, and overall flourishing. God plays a meaningful part in this package of ideals. But for very few is God actually the central focus of their quest. Here, India provides so many opportunities for an alternative testimony that has come to represent for many that very alternative. Indeed, the goal of a spiritual life is stated by so many spiritual seekers. The Hindu tradition says it all. God realization. Perhaps not all know that what God realization means. Perhaps very few attain it. But it is a central governing ideal that informs the lives of thousands, if not millions, of spiritual seekers. Hinduism, as encountered through various teachers and religious groups, presents God at the center in a systematic path to reach knowledge and awareness of God. One of the most common practices of Hindus of different traditions is japa, the repetition of God's name. The quest to keep God's name a constant reality keeps God very much at the center of one's awareness. Even more significantly, the theological structure of Hinduism makes God more readily available than to the Abrahamic faiths. Fundamentally, Hindu approach is the recognition that God is omnipresent and all-pervading. This view allows one to recognize God in all and to find Him everywhere. Most forms of Judaism think of God in transcendent terms, meaning God is above, God is separate from us. Even if they employ religious language that speaks of God in personal terms, even those Jewish traditions that portray God in pantheistic or panentheistic terms do not turn that insight into the governing approach divinity readily available for worship and contact. So what we see here is that Judaism focuses more on transcendence. Chassidut, by the way, more on immanence, no doubt, and that may be why people find meaning in Chassidut and connection to it. But we see that there is, you know, for some people, I'm not saying for everyone, I'm not saying this is true or not true, I'm just saying, speaking of people's experiences, there are definitely people who this resonates with. A sense that there's spirituality lacking, a lack of God focus in their Avodat Hashem. And this behooves us to consider how we could bring this into our Avodat Hashem. We do daven 3 times a day, right? What would it look like if we actually use davening time to talk to God, right? As opposed to just fulfilling a halachic obligation and checking it off. I'm speaking to myself. I'm not just speaking to you. We all find challenge with this. But this is why, you know, it's interesting to think about this encounter. Because there may be certain elements in Hinduism which can inspire us to take a better look and examine Judaism more deeply to seek out those things that many people's souls are seeking. So with this, we conclude. Again, this is just the tip of the iceberg, our encounter with Hinduism. And you know, Zil Gemur, there's a lot more to learn. Yishar Koch on the learning today. Question, Dan?
Yeah.